The name of a 16-year-old is ringing out in the streets of New York. Outside of the UN General Assembly, children chant for their climate hero, Greta Thunberg. And as the UN holds their annual meeting, President Obama's ambassador to the UN takes a hard look at their legacy.
I think all of us have to ask ourselves, would Libya look better today had that not happened?
Also, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is proposing aggressive new climate policies, slashing Germany's carbon emissions. The ambitious goal would have been unimaginable last year, but now, environmentalists say, that's the best you got?
Yeah, it's very disappointing what we have seen yesterday. So the government has really failed to come up with a big deal here.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. New Yorkers often think of their city as the center of the world. And this week, they may be right. World leaders are gathering at the UN General Assembly in Manhattan. There's a lot of critical issues on the docket: Afghanistan, Iran, and Kashmir. And this overarching question looms large. What is U.S. foreign policy these days? The other big topic in New York this week is climate change. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is covering the UN climate summit. She joins us from UN headquarters in Manhattan. Carolyn, the Secretary General called leaders coming to this summit to come not with speeches, but with concrete plans. Has that happened?
There have been some specific actions announced, Carol, which we'll get to a bit later in the show. But big picture, Secretary General Antonio Guterres asked, his key ask was that countries come here armed with plans on how they would cut carbon in half by 2030 on the road to carbon neutrality by 2050. And that goal, that key ask, went largely unmet. His special envoy for this summit told me they hope to have a majority of countries submit new targets on how much carbon they would cut by today. As of right now, just over 60 countries have announced that they intend to enhance their ambition by 2020. That's far from a majority of the 193 UN member states. And those countries are largely small ones, vulnerable island nations, some African countries that represent something like 7% of global emissions. So this summit today is breaking down along pretty familiar lines: small island nations calling for action, larger countries not making a lot of concrete promises.
And then we have the youth. There seems to be a sort of generational issues as well. I mean, youth activism on climate change was very visible on Friday with the global climate demonstrations. Has there been a big youth present there today?
So many, many leaders, when they took the podium, referenced the youth climate movements in their speeches or thanked young people for the activism work that they're doing. Then there was a short panel this morning with youth where Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who launched this school strike movement, gave one of the most impassioned speeches I've ever heard her give, nearly on the verge of tears.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money.
Young people, including Thunberg and adults, took to the streets all over the world on Friday to demand action at today's summit. Today, they even filed a new lawsuit against major emitters. And earlier, over the weekend, I followed around one organizer, both at the strike and here at the UN on Saturday. And, you know, I found that what she wanted was for the youth movement to stop being just about raising awareness, but about becoming part of the solution. I met up with this young activist back on Friday ahead of the New York climate strike. Shia Bastida is armed with her message.
We are scared and we are angry.
The we she refers to are teenagers like her.
And we want our politicians to listen to the science and listen to our message.
I catch the 17-year-old activist in a park in Lower Manhattan between other interviews. She clutches her phone, where notifications are flooding in ahead of the march she helped organize with other young people.
We as youth know that we're going to be the most affected if we don't do bold climate action right now.
Shia grew up in Mexico. She moved to New York 4 years ago when she was 13. But before she did, she saw her hometown being flooded after heavy rains.
That was the first time that I experienced the climate crisis.
In New York, she saw the scars of Hurricane Sandy and started an environmental club at her high school. Then this spring, she started skipping school on Fridays to demonstrate in front of the United Nations. Today, she wears the same green t-shirt as the other organizers, along with neon yellow socks and sneakers for marching. And I notice, while we're talking, she's not just talking into my microphone.
You have three microphones on you.
Three microphones clipped to her collar.
Yeah, like, I have a few people following me for the day.
Teen Vogue, a French news company, a documentary filmmaker, and now me. Bastida is not a household name like Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish activist who started the school strike movement a little over a year ago. But Bastida did go to Washington last week to speak with senators, and she's definitely having a moment.
I'm quoting Greta here, but she said, "I know I get a lot of media, but I'm going to use it to spread the message." And that's the goal.
We want it now! We want change! We want it now! We want change!
Bastida and her fellow organizers in green shirts eventually lead a crowd that will swell to 250,000 people down the streets of Manhattan to Battery Park, where Greta Thunberg herself makes an appearance. Thunberg's fans are in front of her in Battery Park, but her real audience is the leaders gathering at the UN this week, 55 blocks up.
They have a chance to take leadership, to prove they actually hear us. Do you think they hear us?
No!
We will make them hear us.
Bastida has been watching from backstage.
How did that feel?
That felt amazing. We started 4 people organizing. Now it went to 15 people, and now it went to 80 people. And so it's just amazing to see that 15 people who want to change the world can do it.
And there's no doubt Bastida and young people like her have created a global cultural moment. But all that energy has yet to translate into policy changes in key places. In the U.S. and Brazil, in India and China, emissions regulations are being weakened, the Amazon is opening up for business, and new coal-fired power plants are still being built. The UN Secretary General tried to bring these two worlds together on Saturday at the first UN Youth Climate Summit.
Hello.
In the hallways, Shia Bastida meets up with youth leaders she's worked with from all over the country.
Oh my God, I missed you so much! I've been looking for you all day! How are you?
These teenagers leading the movement on climate change have a moment to just be teenagers. Inside the summit, on stage, Secretary General Antonio Guterres gives them major props. He says they've changed the conversation.
There is a change. I feel there is a change in momentum, and largely this change in momentum was due to your initiative and to the courage with which you have started this movement.
Despite the kind words from the Secretary General, she's had a long couple of days, and she doesn't feel like she's had any real conversations with leaders here who could actually make things happen.
We're having two different summits on the same topic, purposely saying this is youth and the other one is high-level officials. Why don't we have both voices in the same space?
Bastida is one of many young poster children who've come to represent the moral imperative to act on climate change. And now that she's helped start a global conversation, she wants to do more than talk.
We need true inclusivity and youth in decision-making. Like, how long can we spread our message before it's too late?
For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler in New York.
The World's Carolyn Beeler will join us again later with more news from the UN Climate Summit. As we've been reporting, children are stepping up to tackle climate change. That's not a surprise to our next guest. After all, children will suffer the consequences. Pediatrician Aaron Bernstein studies the way climate change impacts health, and he has a lot of concerns. He's at Boston Children's Hospital and co-directs the Center for Climate, Health, and the Global Environment at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Bernstein, a big factor you point to is pollution and how it can affect children's developing lungs and brains. Are we seeing this play out already?
We are. We've known for a long time that air pollutants were bad for lungs. But the more we learn about air pollution, the more we realize that it doesn't really care which organ it gets to. We have pretty good evidence that it can damage developing brains. It may be causing Alzheimer's disease over the lifespan. And there's even some preliminary evidence that shows that air pollution may be a factor in autism.
In your research, do you find economic or social disparities and who will be affected the most?
We know that these air pollutants, the particulate matter, the ozone, harm poor people, people of color in the United States more than others. And so if we do what we
need
to do.
Why is that?
Because it turns out that if you're going to buy a house, you don't necessarily want to buy it next to the freeway or next to the industrial plant. And that means that people don't pay as much. And so if you're poorer, you tend to buy houses closer to those areas. And that's just one example. So we see a real opportunity here with stopping burning fossil fuels and addressing some of the big health problems we face.
What's the connection to obesity?
We know that getting more exercise, which means walking and bicycling more, even taking public transit as opposed to sitting in cars, is good for obesity. We know that eating less red meat and potentially higher fat animal products is bad for obesity, and eating more plants is good for obesity. And all these things are also good for carbon. And so if we provide better access to affordable public transit and get people and children out of sitting in cars, if we give children places to play outdoors, green space is good for outdoor recreation, it's good for air pollution, it's good for sequestering carbon, we can in fact address obesity.
What about mental health impacts? What are you seeing in terms of children?
We've had the misfortune of watching disasters unfold, disasters associated with climate change. And when children have to deal with these disasters, it not only can affect their mental health in the near term, but for a long time. So children who were affected by Katrina were followed for years out, and we see increased rates of certain mental health symptoms in them. And we know that in a child who experiences these so-called adverse childhood events, that the more of them a child gets, the more likely it can affect things beside their mental health across the lifespan. So they may die earlier. They may have higher rates of cancer. They may engage in more risk-taking behavior. And so these form a part of what we pediatricians call ACEs, or adverse childhood events, that through toxic stress can lead to adverse health outcomes. At the same time, again, the solutions to climate change, including things like improving green space in cities, have been shown to have tremendous benefit to childhood mental health.
I'm wondering if there are places around the world, cities or whole countries, that are taking these kinds of steps to address health effects in children.
At any number of places around the world, people are really engaged on climate. In the United States, we see cities and states doing tremendous things around what they want to do for energy production, food systems, transportation. But I think your question is well taken, which is that we don't necessarily think about children when we do these things. And I think that's why the climate strikes that happened this past week were so important, because our children were calling us to account. And so when we look at any policy at any state or local level, we often ask, what does this mean to adults? But we don't ask what it means to our children. And if I could make anything clear, I don't know what it is that we have to be thinking about our children, whether we're dealing with the acute effects of air pollution in our cities today and the disproportionate impacts they have on children, or for the long term and the carbon pollution and what that means to the world we want our children to live in.
Aaron Bernstein is a pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital. He's also the co-director of the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we're back at the UN General Assembly in New York, looking at what's happening on the sidelines there. We'll visit a forum for young entrepreneurs. It's sponsored by a UN organization and a charity that's funded by Saudi Arabia. The event almost didn't happen. The host, the New York Public Library, pulled the plug over concerns about Saudi Arabia's human rights record. But the show will go on at a new location, a luxurious Wall Street venue. Controversy on the sidelines at the UN General Assembly, that's tomorrow. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. If a Democrat wins the 2020 presidential election, Samantha Power would likely be on any shortlist for Secretary of State. Power was a journalist, a human rights activist, and a UN ambassador for President Barack Obama. She has a new memoir out. It's called The Education of an Idealist. In it, she comes across as an idealistic humanitarian, determined to right wrongs. I asked her where that impulse came from.
I was raised Catholic in Ireland and very early on learned do unto others as you'd have done unto yourself. But I also tell the story in the book of my father who died when I was very young. He was a drinker and we grew up in Ireland till I was nine. And definitely I felt like I was the person who was the closest to him, and in some level, some subconscious level, I think for much of my life, I felt I wasn't there for him and didn't manage somehow to get him to give up the drink and take care of himself. And of course, that's what a child thinks often, and it's a bit unfair on oneself. But maybe there's something in that as well that you then translate into your work life later on.
I ask it in part because a lot of your approach to foreign policy and the U.S.'s role in the world is that the U.S. has a special role to play and the U.S. can make a difference in people's lives overseas. And I know that that was a big impetus behind your strong push for intervention in Libya in 2011. You were a key voice in pushing for the U.S. to intervene. And 1,600 airstrikes later, Muammar Gaddafi is toppled. Some called President Obama's decision a personal triumph for you. It was framed as a response in many ways to an impending humanitarian disaster in Benghazi. I first want to play a clip of the president because he uses a lot of language that you use to justify the intervention.
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action.
Now, at this point, Libya is a failed state. It has been for some time. And its collapse has sent millions of refugees to European shores. It's emboldened nationalists in Europe. In hindsight, was that attempt at a humanitarian intervention a mistake?
Well, first, let me just take issue with the idea that this was a personal triumph for me. I mean, using military force anywhere is should be nobody's personal triumph. But we were in a situation where the entire world, including the Arab League, NATO, the UN Security Council, were pressing for something to be done to avert what looked like a surefire massacre. I think the challenge is, you know, when there are societies that are so ravaged from within as Gaddafi had done to the Libyan people, I don't think once the Arab Spring began in that country that you were looking at a potentially restabilized society. And so the decision before us was not, is Libya going to be put back together or is there any going back to the pre-Arab Spring moment, but rather, do we have a responsibility given the number of countries that are calling on us to act? So I guess I just question the premise a little bit, which is, had the United States not answered the call of the Libyans and of so many in the international community, would Libya look different today? Maybe. I mean, we can't run history a second time. But what we, I think, do know is that many, many people would have been killed in that first instance.
But I think what's a tough one about the Libya situation is that former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, he opposed it. Colin Powell has a saying, you know, you break it, you own it. I mean, at some point, don't you and the Obama administration own a part of the failure of Libya?
One of the things I try to do in the book is to bring people into the Situation Room and have them experience what it was like, including hearing Secretary Gates and his argument. At the same time, of course, Secretary Gates supported the invasion of Iraq and the troop surge in Afghanistan. And so I try to bring you into the room and have you make your own judgment. Absolutely, I think all of us have to ask ourselves, would Libya look better today had that not happened? Our challenge in the aftermath of NATO's action is that the Libyans said to us, we don't want any international presence on the ground, none. So I think Colin Powell's saying really does apply, you sort of break it, you fix it, but it was pretty broken at the point at which Gaddafi's forces were at the gates of Benghazi. And I suspect, had we not acted, the questions you'd be posing to me right now would be about why we didn't act in Libya and why tens of thousands of people were killed. It's just these are extremely vexing, wrenching challenges.
You mentioned Syria, and I want to move to Syria. At the time of the red line and chemical weapons, President Obama nominated you to become the U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
One of our foremost thinkers on foreign policy, she showed us that the international community has a moral responsibility and a profound interest in resolving conflicts and defending human dignity.
You were very outspoken during your tenure at the U.N. You were calling out the Assad regime in Syria and its Russian and Iranian backers.
You are plotting your next assault. Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit?
I remember hearing you when you said that at the time. It's very passionate. In the end, President Obama decided not to attack Syria after the Assad regime crossed Obama's own red line and used chemical weapons. Why aren't you more outspoken in your book about your criticism of Obama's fateful decision?
I think I'm honest about it. Again, in light of the conversation we just had about Libya, it's extremely risky to be using military force in other countries. This was an instance where, as UN ambassador, I tried to help the president mobilize a large global coalition in support of what he was contemplating, which was very, very limited military action to punish the use of chemical weapons. So I experienced firsthand the lack of enthusiasm on the part of all the countries of the world, really, with the exception of France. But again, these are really tough decisions. And what I do in my book is bring people into those decisions and also explain President Obama's side of the story of what it would have been like absent strong domestic support, absent a global coalition, absent a UN Security Council authorization. The risks of doing something like that were not small.
I'm going to switch gears more to the present right now. If a Democrat wins the 2020 presidential election, you'd certainly be on a short list for Secretary of State. Are you interested in that job?
I'm interested right now in bringing my story of trying to make a difference to particularly to young people. I think a lot of people in the world have lost faith that they can do something in light of the magnitude of the problems we face, whether climate change or 70 million displaced people or, again, the Arab Spring starting and offering so much promise and then collapsing in so many places and so much heartache. We're facing and have been for years now a human rights recession around the world, and the temptation is to just say, oh, read another book, Why Democracies Fail, Why Democracies Die, 1984. But my feeling when I was ambassador and my feeling to this day is there's always something you can do. And really, I think more than anything, the lesson of the Arab Spring is stresses really the importance of political evolution rather than revolution, because once revolution occurs, what gets unleashed is beyond the control of most mortals.
Samantha Power is an author, a human rights activist. She was a presidential advisor and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Obama administration. Her new memoir is called The Education of an Idealist. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
You're with The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. And at gs.com/podcast.
For nearly two centuries, British travelers turned to Thomas Cook for their vacation needs.
With the Thomas Cook Holiday Pledge, we promise to find you a holiday resort that fits all your requirements or give you your money back.
Let's see. Pony riding? Swimming?
Don't just book it. Thomas Cook It is no more. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The UN General Assembly is meeting this week in New York. Today, the main focus is climate change. We're back with The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. She's at the UN's Climate Action Summit in New York. Carolyn, to gauge how successful the summit has been, you've been watching who says what and who didn't even show up at the summit. How successful has been going at this point?
So as expected, of course, the U.S. Was not on the stage. President Trump did actually stop by for a few minutes to watch the proceedings on his way to speaking at another U.N. summit happening here, one on religious freedom. But here on this side of the U.N., two other big emitters, China and India, did get spots on stage, even though none of them met either of the big demands that the Secretary General was calling for ahead of this summit. So an aim toward carbon neutrality by 2050 or to stop building new coal-fired power plants by next year. And this just shows the bind that the Secretary General and the UN are really in. Under the Paris Agreement, they can ask countries for commitments, but they cannot by any means force them. So it's really up to these countries to decide what they're going to bring to the table.
So if China and India didn't talk about what they're going to cut, what did they say when they got up there?
India's Modi pledged further investment on renewable energy, a target of 450 gigawatt capacity. That was new. And perhaps the biggest news or maybe disappointment today is that China, the world's biggest emitter, did not commit to new targets for cutting carbon by 2020. So far, they have pledged, under the Paris Agreement, they pledged to hit peak emissions by 2030. There was some hope that they might announce that they would hit that target much sooner or actually announce new, more ambitious targets. And today, in a rather innocuous statement, China's representative Wang Yi dashed those hopes. Here he is through a UN interpreter.
China will faithfully fulfill our obligations under the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement and realize as scheduled its nationally determined contribution targets.
There was a little piece of news from another big emitter, Russia. They finally ratified the Paris Agreement today.
Oh.
But the top line today is that while smaller, vulnerable nations are calling for action and youth have made a big splash here, larger emitters, including China, India, and the U.S., are kicking the can down the road to 2020 when their new emission standards will actually come due. Now, that is with a few caveats, including Germany.
The World's Environment reporter, Carolyn Beeler, in New York. Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany spoke at the UN's Climate Action Summit today, pledging to ban coal use in her country.
Die Entwicklungsländer sind die Hauptleidtragenden.
Merkel also said today that industrial nations have caused global warming and developing countries are suffering the most. Merkel said industrial countries have an obligation to stop global warming, and Germany will double its funding commitment for global climate protection. In Germany last Friday, Merkel's government unveiled an aggressive new plan to tackle climate change. But critics at home are calling her new policies faint-hearted and disappointing. Reporter Rachel Waldhotz takes a look.
In Berlin on Friday, it was all about climate change. More than 100,000 people gathered at the city's iconic Brandenburg Gate, demanding more action. The protests here, like others around the world, were led by young people walking out of school, and they chanted what has become the strikers' signature slogan. We're here, we're loud, because you're stealing our future. That accusation is aimed squarely at Germany's politicians, especially Chancellor Angela Merkel, who protesters say isn't doing enough to combat climate change. And Merkel has definitely heard them.
Ja, meine Damen und Herren, ich möchte Sie begrüßen zur Pressekonferenz.
Just blocks away from the protest, the Chancellor held a press conference to unveil a new proposal to get Germany on track to meet its commitments under the Paris Climate Agreement. Merkel said action on climate change is non-negotiable.
Es ist nicht so, dass wir hier irgendetwas Ideologisches machen, sondern wir machen etwas, wofür es so massive Evidenzen gibt.
We're not doing something ideological here, she said, but something for which there is massive evidence. With that, she introduced a plan to spend about $60 billion over the next few years to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and said Germany will aim for net zero carbon emissions by 2050. To help get there, the plan sets a new price on emissions from vehicles and buildings. In many countries, like the U.S., this would all be a pretty big deal. But here in Germany, the reaction has been frustration.
It's very disappointing. The government has really failed to come up with a big deal here.
That's Brigitte Knopf of the Mercator Research Institute. She helped advise Merkel's government on setting up the new carbon pricing system. But she says the government's proposal is way too weak. The plan would set the initial price at 10 euros per ton of CO2 emissions. To put that in context, it would raise the price of a gallon of gas by about 10 cents.
And that's far too low to have an effect, a substantial steering effect. And according to our calculations, this price should have been 5 times higher.
Knopf wasn't the only one disappointed. Headlines throughout the country panned the plan. But here's the thing. Just a year ago, a climate package this ambitious would have been unimaginable. Germany has a reputation as an international climate leader, but in recent years, the country has struggled to cut emissions, and politicians seemed unwilling to do more. And then, in the last 18 months, the politics of climate change shifted.
A stifling heat wave is blanketing Europe this weekend.
A major heat wave in the summer of 2018 smashed records across the continent. Then, last winter, students started walking out of school on Fridays to demand more action on climate change. Germany had some of the biggest student climate protests in the world. And then, in May...
what they're calling the Green Wave. Really strong performances by the Greens.
The Green Party made major gains in the European elections, surging into second place in Germany. Matthias Buck is a researcher with the think tank Agora Energiewende. He says the political terrain has changed completely.
Everybody in Germany has realized that you cannot win the next national election unless you have a credible response to climate change in your pocket.
Buck says the government's plan doesn't meet that standard, but it is a step forward. Germany will now have an emissions trading system and a set of binding emissions targets, both of which can be tightened in the future. As for Merkel, she had a message for her critics.
Das unterscheidet Politik auch von Wissenschaft.
What distinguishes politics from science and impatient young people, she said, is that politics is what's possible. Protesters aren't satisfied with that. The student organizers of Friday's protest called Merkel's plan a bad joke and said politicians must do more. Until then, they say, we'll see you in the streets. The next strike is this Friday. For the World, Rachel Waldholz, Berlin.
Back at the UN General Assembly meeting this week in New York, outside on the streets, artists are getting in on the action, making a loud case for world leaders to address our climate crisis. This year, Manhattan is flooded with colorful signs, large earth balloons, and oversized papier-mâché heads of world leaders. But this artistic protest takes things to a whole new level. A Swiss artist is transplanting a forest into the middle of a soccer stadium in Austria. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
The aerial view of the project is the most disorienting, in my opinion. You're looking straight down into the stadium, and you can see the bleachers and the floodlights. But instead of the soccer pitch, you see a forest, like it was dumped there as a prank or by mistake. But it's no mistake. The art project in Klagenfurt, Austria, has been years in the making, and it was quite an undertaking. The artist, Klaus Littmann, and his team transplanted 300 trees from nurseries in Italy, Germany, and Belgium, some of them full-grown and weighing up to 6 tons. And don't worry, the artists say no trees were harmed in the making of this project. At this point, you may be wondering, why? Why would somebody do this? Littmann says he was inspired by a pencil drawing from 1971. In this drawing, spectators are gathered around a soccer stadium, but instead of watching a game, they're watching a forest. In his promotional video, Littmann says he was so taken by the picture, he went to visit the artist, Max Pintour.
When he had this idea that maybe one day we will have only the chance to see nature in a space like this, like a stadium. So that what we do already with animals in the zoo, that was for me really very, very impressive. And then I said to him, listen, this idea is so fantastic. I think we have to realize it, or I want to realize it. And then he said to me, if you want. But I think he didn't take it serious. But now, 30 years later, nearly 30 years later,
Visitors to the exhibit can't touch the trees or enter the forest. All they can do is look.
Wenn man dort nach vorne geht und man sieht plötzlich die Natur hinter Gittern.
These visitors say, if you go to the front, you suddenly see nature behind bars. You don't have access to it. It's like a memorial and really gives you food for thought.
Ich mag das gerne, dass er einfach...
I like the fact that we're forced to see the forest. When we go for a walk in the forest, we assume it's always going to be there. Not everyone is as moved by the project. It got some unwanted attention from two of Austria's far-right parties. The stadium in Klagenfurt was backed by the late far-right politician Jörg Haider, and his followers apparently didn't enjoy seeing the stadium co-opted by an art project. Klaus Littmann, the artist, says he was even accosted in the street by someone shouting, "Go away and take your forest." It will ultimately go away and become a soccer stadium again, but not until the end of October. After that, all 300 trees will be replanted in a nearby public field. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Seeing is Believing. You can check out that forest in the center of a soccer stadium at our Instagram page. We're at PRI The World. At today's all-day climate summit in New York, President Trump made a brief and unexpected appearance. He was in the audience listening for just 14 minutes. In another chamber, though, Trump was up in front, delivering a speech about religious freedom. That's something his administration has talked about a lot. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, critics say the rhetoric has not always matched the reality.
Donald Trump told a gathering at the UN today that protecting religious freedom is one of his highest priorities.
Today, with one clear voice, the United States of America calls upon the nations of the world to end religious persecution.
Trump said around 80% of the world's population lives in countries where religious freedom is under threat. He said people of many different faiths right now are being jailed, tortured, and even murdered for their beliefs. And he called on governments around the world to take action.
To stop the crimes against people of faith, release prisoners of conscience, repeal laws restricting freedom of religion and belief, protect the vulnerable, the defenseless, and the oppressed. America stands with believers in every country who ask only for the freedom to live according to the faith that is within their own hearts.
Trump announced $25 million in new funding to protect religious liberty and a new partnership with private companies to address the issue, though he didn't mention details. Sean Casey worked on religious and global affairs at the Obama State Department. He applauds the Trump administration for raising the issue of religious liberty in speeches and at conferences. But Casey says the president's policies fall short.
In terms of action, I would argue he's probably the least effective president on religious liberty in the last 20 years.
Casey says it started with Trump's travel ban, preventing people from Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S., and on the two biggest examples of religious persecution, with Muslims in Western China and the Rohingya minority in Myanmar. He says the Trump administration has done little to nothing.
They've had no diplomatic initiatives. They've been unable to change the behavior of the Myanmar government or the Chinese government.
There are some bright spots with the administration's record on religious liberty, says Galen Carey with the National Association of Evangelicals. Appointing a special ambassador was an important step, he says. But Carey says there's one big disconnect.
The administration's policy on refugees is very lamentable.
Carey says that the U.S. has had a historic and bipartisan commitment to offering asylum to people of different faiths from all over the world who faced religious persecution. The Trump White House has cut way back on refugee resettlement programs, and Kerry says that does not serve the administration's stated goal of promoting religious freedom.
I mean, the number of refugees to be resettled this year, somewhat under 30,000, compared to our historic numbers of between 80,000 to 100,000. And there's even discussion of further lowering that number, which we think would be tragic. So we've called for the president to actually restore the refugee resettlement program to its historic levels.
But Trump's evangelical base is still on board. One prominent pastor told Fox News today that the president had guts for ignoring the, quote, imaginary problem of climate change to talk about religious liberty. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The oldest travel agency out there is no longer.
With the Thomas Cook Holiday Pledge, we promise to find you a holiday resort that fits all your requirements or give you your money back.
Let's see.
Money should be coming back to hundreds of thousands of travelers who booked through Thomas Cook. The British tour operator took millions of people on vacation each year for nearly 180 years. But Thomas Cook's CEO, Peter Funkhauser, said Brexit led many British customers to delay their travel plans this summer.
I would like to say sorry to all our customers.
The collapse triggered Britain's largest ever peacetime repatriation. The British government is now helping 150,000 people find their way back home. In total, an estimated 600,000 people from multiple nations are stranded. 57-year-old Wendy Willis was on a flight from Florida to the UK.
As soon as we landed, they were all crying. It's devastating. It's a legacy. It's gone.
Simon Calder is a travel expert in the UK. Simon, many of us have never heard of Thomas Cook until today. What exactly is it?
Well, it's the oldest travel brand in the world. It's the company that, starting in 1841, democratized, revolutionized, industrialized travel, and by doing so, helped initially the British, then many other nationalities to expand their horizons by cutting the cost of travel and opening up new opportunities. So a very, very proud brand. Known well in Europe, big in Britain, even bigger in Germany. But sadly, after 178 years, the brand is no more. The company went out of business British time 2 a.m. on Monday.
Now, we heard from one passenger there, but there are 600,000 people whose holidays are being impacted. Is there a specific story that struck you?
Look, I have been dealing with many, many people who saying that they are stranded at resorts mainly around Europe, the Mediterranean in particular. And I've been trying to persuade them, you're not stranded, you're on vacation, because while Thomas Cook was sinking into the mire of debt that finally claimed it, the aviation authority in the UK was setting up a shadow airline, bringing in aircraft from around the world effectively to mimic the schedule. So people who are, for example, due to come back on the weekend, they can sit by the pool, order another drink, knowing that there will be a flight from their location back to the UK, maybe to a slightly different airport on the day they were supposed to travel back. They are in a much stronger position than the 800,000 people who have forward bookings, all of which have been wiped out. While they'll get their money back, the price of all other holidays and flights has risen since the collapse. And of course, 22,000 employees around the world who are now looking for jobs, most of them in Northern Europe, just as the summer season is coming to an end and demand for travel staff has dwindled.
Now, what is the thing that made Thomas Cook so revolutionary? Are they sort of package trips that are cheap and include hotel and air? I mean, why was it so successful?
Well, Thomas Cook in the later part of the 19th century absolutely transformed travel. The very first trip that Thomas Cook himself, an ardent temperance enthusiast, anti-alcohol, was to take people from the city of Leicester in the English Midlands, just 10 miles up the railway line to a place called Loughborough for a temperance meeting. But in fact, many of the 500 people on that trip simply wanted to see what it was like going on a railway train. And this was their opportunity. And by industrializing the travel process, which nobody had ever done before, he managed to extend horizons. And that carried through into the 20th century, particularly through the 70s and 80s. Thomas Cook was at the forefront of delivering great quality, very economical holidays. But then they failed to notice that open skies, which, as in the US, was emulated in Europe with airlines such as EasyJet and Ryanair growing out of the opportunities, they also failed to spot that something called the internet was going to make organizing travel an awful lot easier for people. It was just a legacy company, great in the 20th century, clearly unfit for purpose in the 21st.
What does this mean for the travel industry?
This is going to accelerate the transformation of the travel industry by greatly reducing the number of actual travel agents who are selling holidays to people who walk into stores. And that's probably overdue. Of course, there's plenty of room for travel professionals, but the idea of sort of simply order takers, that is, I think, consigned to history.
Do you have any favorite travel memories with Thomas Cook?
Thomas Cook was, because I'm of a certain age, I'm in my 60s, Thomas Cook was the place where you began your adventures. They had a wonderful heritage. For anybody who wanted to explore Europe, this was an absolute godsend.
Simon Calder is a travel expert in the UK. Dubai is where Europeans go on holiday to shop till they drop. This guy, Soapy, goes there for a different reason. The hip-hop and R&B singer is from California, but Soapy now divides his time between L.A. and Dubai because he sees an opportunity to make his mark there. Man, I swear it's crazy. I've been running solo looking for
some new inspiration. Imagine that. One of the reasons I'm in Dubai is that it poses an interesting challenge. It doesn't have a well-established urban music scene. but it has a lot of people who want hip-hop and want R&B. And I know you said you can't feel things come down too fast when you get faded, nah, nah. Contrary to Los Angeles, where you have the music industry and the film industry and established businesses, we don't have that as much in Dubai. I thought that was an interesting opportunity to be able to cultivate that in whatever way I can. And while people from the music scene in Dubai and generally in the entire region are looking to the West, I was looking to Dubai as a huge opportunity to play even a small part in making hip-hop more of a global genre. Were you out to your knees a weekend? Were you out till you can't even speak it? And I know you said you can't feel things come down too fast when you get faded, nah, nah.
That's musician Soapy in Dubai, spinning a recent song of his called Imagine That. Now imagine this. We're out of here. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow for another spin of the world.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.